So yeah, glad you're not lynching me for the essay results. But there were two of us. There were two of us. Again, if you've got things you want to discuss, just let me know. But today we're going to be speaking about just general revision for the exams, some of which you'll probably already be familiar with from your other modules, but so bear with me if some of this is familiar. And again, just beginning with basics such as, there is a link here provided to the study aid site. If I can get my cursor to work. And that really just tells you about revising for exams, and it's nothing sort of earth-shaking, but it's just to say that what you want to do is naturally pick out a subset of the topics that you're going to focus on, and in the case of this module, like all modules, you've got 14 weeks. 12 of those weeks will be covered, two will not, by questions. But even though 12 weeks will be covered by questions, there will be two either-or questions, which forces you to choose only one of those two. So you have to actually be a bit broader, especially when we're dealing with two sections that are where there's overlap in topic. So I'm going to leave that up to you to think of what parts of the course might overlap, but it's a way of saying that you don't want to just put all your eggs in one basket and focus just on three topics out of 14, and especially three topics that are very closely related so that you can spin off similar types of answers to both questions. That's the reason we have those either-ors, is to prevent people essentially just studying one body of material and spreading it liberally across a number of topics. So that's the first thing, and this will just give you a bit on revising, and the obvious point here is to not just read your notes and say, okay, I've learned that, but actually practice writing exam questions, past exam questions or essay questions, if possible to a timer, because as we'll see here, there are three questions in 3 hours, 1 hour per question. And so what we're saying in effect is, let's say you revise five topics or four or five to cover yourself for three questions. What you really want to practice is setting out the skeleton, the outline that you're going to follow in your exam answer. And so for each question on the exam, you should be taking an hour. And for each hour, you want to take 5 minutes to set out the outline of your answer. And it's just a way of, it helps to organize your thoughts. You can then fill in and you can keep referring to that structure, because if you just dive in sometimes, and I will admit a lot of people do dive in, and sometimes it works, but sometimes people can really, really get into what is an ethnic group, define that in great detail, and then forget about the question, lose sight of what the actual essay question is. So you don't want to fall into that trap. So that's one benefit. The other benefit is just, if, I know this will not happen to any of you, but if you are out of time, then at least we can see what you might have been getting at, and that'll give you something anyway. So it's worth taking those 5 minutes per question to do an essay plan. And so one of the things, and then what we'll do a little bit later on, is to practice drawing up that 5 minute essay plan. And that's sort of what you'll in your revision, you should try and come up with some idea of what are the basic theoretical arguments, how do I see those particular theories, do I see them, which do I think makes sense against the evidence, because that's kind of, it's very similar to an essay, similar things that we're going to be looking for. So with exams, they're like miniature essays without the footnoting, without the referencing. Obviously much shorter, because you don't have the time really to go into the same detail that you do on the essays. But what we're after is pretty similar, in that you need to answer the question that's posed, not necessarily the question that you've revised for. I mean, the question you've revised for will undoubtedly be relevant to the question that's asked, but you have to make sure you answer the question that is asked rather than an ideal question you might have in your mind. Don't just sort of say, oh, I revised this and now I'm going to download to the page. You want to actually answer the question that's been asked. Needless to say, having a structured answer is very important, where you don't just reel off authors and details and cases and arguments, but actually try and organize the arguments into competing accounts. The obvious one in nationalism theory is just ethno-symbolists versus modernists, but it doesn't have to necessarily be that. It could be, yes, multiculturalism has declined, no, it hasn't. What's the evidence? Or you can look at a question. The question will often suggest the way to break down your reply, your answer. Just in terms of the marking criteria, if you go to the course book, which I'm trying to do, and this is the module handbook, you'll see sort of towards the bottom here in these appendices, which I know people don't read, but actually there are some interesting things in there on what we're looking for in terms of assessment. And this is on page 32. So just as on in terms of your essay feedback, you've got this kind of a structure. Answering the question and structure, those are the top two. If you can nail those two, you're most of the way there. These other things are perhaps less interesting for exam questions. So answering the question, does it deal directly with the assigned task and provide a focused answer? And structure, extent to which it provides coherent organization of the material and an argument that proceeds logically, which when they say logically, that generally means one argument, counter-argument, and then the conclusion where you assess the two. So that's sort of the basics on that. Style is more an issue for essays and dissertations than for exam questions. And then you're familiar with the marking schema. Okay, so that's sort of, and again, it's something we're marking quite similarly across exam, essay, and even dissertation. You know, that there's a lot of similar elements about being critical, not just describing, having an argument. You know, the killer is always, oh, you've just described everything that happened in Syria, but you haven't, you know, given us any insight into which particular argument about the conflict makes more sense. You know, that kind of an issue is very important. Okay. And then literally in terms of exam structure and technique, so we've said revise at the very minimum 3 to 4, probably better to cover off 5 just in case, but certainly 4. And that then gives you a base from which you can address a number of questions that might come up. The broader you are, the more you'll be able to handle the different questions. So it doesn't hurt to have an extra question in the pocket. And if you can bring in, you know, sometimes it makes sense if you can bring in little bits of material spanning a number of different topics, that can't hurt you. Although, of course, you'll want to focus in the main on the readings and articles that are germane to that week. And really, that's all I have to say in terms of a lecture. What I would next like to do is to have us just look at the essay questions. Now, of course, this is a new module, and much of the material on it is new. There are some sections that have been covered in previous years on other courses, and that's that is worth noting. I'm not saying that that's going to give you much, but it'll give you some indication of what an essay question might look like. Let me just see if I can get us to... So there has, in this course here on nationalism and international context, if we just go to the 11-12 exam paper. There's the odd question here that you will recognize. There's a few of them that are demographically, like number 2 here, or number 10. So there are, I think if you go to this exam paper, you'll get some idea of, at the very least, what an exam question would look like. But actually, the essay questions are also very similar, and that's probably your best bet for revision, especially for a topic that's not on here. So yeah, do you have any questions? Yeah, go ahead.
So will there be any
marked papers
that we can work from?
Marked papers? The only thing you can really go on are past exam papers for this nationalism and international context.
So, but if it's not a module, if it's not a section that's been covered on those,
if it's not a section that's... There's no mock... basically, for this, you really have to just go on the essay questions. And to be honest, whether there was a past paper or not, it's not going to really add much, because it's the same as... I mean, the questions are essentially similar in format to the essay questions. So I wouldn't be too hung up on the exact wording of different questions. It's just to say we could, you know, this question here, is multiculturalism in retreat in Britain? I mean, it could be phrased differently. It might, there might be a question about something like, was multiculturalism ever deployed in Britain? Not the same question, but it's drawing on a lot of similar material. So it's just, if you've studied an area well, you should be able to handle the different permutations that come up on that. What's that? I know you'd like it.
If you're revising, if you say you revise from essay question, from past exam paper,
yeah, that's why.
Yeah,
I mean, unfortunately, I wouldn't think it's going to make much difference, but just the different phrasings, you mean, of the way the questions could come up. Right. Yeah, I mean, we wouldn't have a backlog of papers. It is, unfortunately, you guys are the guinea pigs. I mean, it's a new it's a new model. I will say that some of the questions are those that appear in this course, so you will get some idea from this course.
It's to do with a dissertation question.
You can ask me about it. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, whereby they say on the MSc dissertation, the onus is not on you, it's like it's not an obligation that you have to do primary research. Mm. You just question secondary literature.
Right. That's absolutely correct. I mean, if you're doing something that's more theoretical, then you don't necessarily need to do primary work. It's only if you're trying to dig up new facts. If your contribution is fact-based, then you would lean to more primary material. But really, the guts of almost every master's thesis is secondary sources, because we still put a lot of emphasis on having a theoretical argument and demonstrating that you understand the theories. You might look very much in depth at a case study, but then you don't necessarily have to be the one who's dug up the new facts on, Syrian Christians and their history and conflict. You don't necessarily have to show that primary data, as long as you are able to construct a strong argument and back it up with evidence. The evidence could have been supplied by a previous writer. So yeah, that's sort of what we mean by that. Okay. Okay, so once you've picked a question, I want to give you sort of a time limit of, I should give you 5 minutes. Because you will have studied and prepared something, and that's going to take you a little while, I'll extend it to about 10 minutes. So I'm going to give you 10 minutes to pick a topic and come up with an essay or an exam answer plan that you might be able to write your answer from. So, and that'll also, we'll do this exercise and you'll see that it'll also have a bearing on answering the question. So, structure and answer question is the key here. So I'm going to give you 10 minutes. Take it away. All right, so...
Are you going to mark us on what we say?
Well, no, I won't mark you, but it'll be interesting to... Okay, so we'll start in the back. Okay, I could. You guys in the back, what was your question, first of all?
We chose
10A. 10A, okay. And what was the... Sorry, it's not highlighting. Oops, don't forget that. And how would you approach it?
the different demographic factors. It's started by saying yes, it is important. And then
right.
Both the demographic factors, and we would think we might have some possible writers.
Okay. Well, I would. Yeah. Did you want to add to that? Okay. Before commenting, I will come back to you, but I'll first sound you guys out, and then I will come back on both of you. Okay, go ahead. Which question did you...
Number four.
Okay. And how did you approach that?
Yeah, we just have to say, we would first just easily ask a question in our mind, yes or no.
Okay.
And then... go with that line of it. Would if we say yes, it is,
mm-hmm.
Then we would start the arguments, like authors' theories on that, and then
right.
The arguments that why, like evidences to our answer, why
right.
We think it is.
Okay.
The conclusion.
So you set out why you think it is based on a certain set of authors, and then you would do. The counter-argument, okay. All right. Yeah, I think that's the right approach, generally speaking. So, you'd want to show that you understood, you know, the Oshii say, basically, the argument that says, yes, they are very important foreign policy actors because they can marshal resources, or whatever it is that you want to argue, and then you would, the counter-argument might be that, you know, actually, but that's a very good way of structuring that kind of an argument, and you're answering the question too, right? Because the question is, are they important? Not what are the different types of foreign policy actors or the different types of diaspora, or something like that. That's not actually the question. Even if you might have revised that distinction, you actually have to make reference to this question. Now, of course, you can bring in other kinds of arguments about. That exact question.
Here, do you have to actually have a counter-argument as such, or your counter-argument simply be, if we base it as we model, one says, okay, certain conditions are met, then they can be powerful,
right?
The diaspora can be important. So my question is, can the counter-argument be the fact, be this? If the model is not achieved, or if the conditions for the model are not fulfilled, then no. So it's
yes.
Not a counter argument as such, but
right.
It's just, you know, the opposite.
That's a very good way of approaching it. So it is still saying that, you know, you still, I suppose, could set out the idea that, you know, sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. But in your conclusion section where you actually assess these two, you would say, what really helps to adjudicate is if these conditions are present, then it is they are important. If those conditions are absent, then it's not important. So that would be in the final section. And of course, you don't have to give equal weight to the counter argument and the main argument. As long as you're showing that you're aware that there are counter arguments in enough detail, that's fine. Maybe there aren't very maybe there's not much material on the counter argument. So you don't necessarily have to give equal weight. You could still largely be talking about one argument, but it just shows that you're aware that it is a debate, and that you justify your answer in the end as to which perspective you think is more convincing. So that's what I'd say on that. Yeah, absolutely.
We're talking about cases.
Okay. It's always more advantageous if you are able to reference authors and cases. That certainly adds to your to the mark that you're going to get. The danger, of course, is if you get sucked into the detail. And I've seen this happen on exam questions. And you only have an hour, and it's not necessarily as much. It's not that much time. I mean, it's enough time, but if you really start getting into the details of what happened in Catalonia. Then you know you can get into some detail. You can use it to illustrate the theoretical point. But if you really describe which parties came first and second and third, you know what I mean. So cases are important as evidence for you backing up your arguments. But don't get drawn down the description route, is what I'd say. Okay, so you guys. Did, remind me again which one you did, 10?
10,
10A. 10A, how important are demographic factors? Well, you talked about different demographic factors, which of course will be part of the argument, but I would say you'd at least want to reference an argument that says actually they don't matter very much versus another argument that says they matter. So, because that question is asking about sort of how important you would want to be able to say, I've looked at the argument that says it's not very important because, let's say, group boundaries can be manipulated by instrumental elites. Whatever the argument might be, that essentially group boundaries are flexible and constructed, therefore, no matter what happens with the demography, they can just be reconstructed. So it doesn't matter that much. Versus an argument that says actually it matters, and these are the ways in which it matters. And then, to sum up, you would want to look at perhaps some cases that illustrated your point. Or you might say, well, in these instances, it's very important, but without these conditions in place, it's not very important. Or something of that nature. So that's kind of the way I think you'd want to handle that. Yeah.
Question A to question 10A.
Yeah.
Like, it shows the difference between tension and conflict, but aren't they, you'd use the same.
They're quite close, you're right. They are.
I didn't answer either. But,
yeah, you're right about that.
I don't really see a difference.
Yeah. I think you would, if you were answering 8 and 10A, I mean, I could be, this is going back some years, you can be pretty sure you won't see two questions this close anymore. But you would have to show substantially different answers anyway in order to, if you just kind of repeated the same thing. But on this case, you're right, that is actually reasonably close, so you'd probably have to lean to the religion aspect rather than... You couldn't produce the same identical answer, no. I mean, it would
be the same, it should be...
Well, as long as... if it were to happen, yeah, that's fine. If you are answering the question and you've got a structured argument, what can we say? I mean, you know, nothing, really. That's our fault for drafting two questions that are relatively similar, so yeah. I don't think that'll happen this time, though. Now, okay, what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, is to do another, have another go at it, maybe on a question on your, one of the essay questions, actually. I mean, you can still do one of these, but I think maybe if we each picked one of the essay questions, so I'll give you another 10 minutes on that.
expectations are not met in terms of either economic well-being and prosperity problems or political rights and having a share in the establishment and in the governing of the country, so greed versus grievance, then you have a big potential for violence. So that is where we would go. Say yes, or you would explain why or what the relationship is. So, big youth population, all of a sudden, their expectations are not met, so this can trigger violence. And then, in the body of the answer, we would elaborate on the argument of greed versus grievance. We will come up with examples. The Arab Spring, you have countries which, failing to have birth control or for whatever reason, they have big youth populations, youth bulge, and most of them are educated, but the job market cannot accommodate them, and politically maybe there's also no room for them because you have a system of, you know, clientelism and the elite which has a big share of the cake, and therefore you have violence. Obviously, you have a lot of examples for this, and then we were kind of trying to think about some counter examples or counter arguments. We didn't remember a real counter argument, so to speak, but you can maybe argue for cases in which we talked about Saudi Arabia or some of the other Persian Gulf states where the government, so to speak, buys the silence of the population by subsidizing everything. You know, in Kuwait, virtually the electricity bills are never paid, so cheap the government doesn't come after you. So that, for the time being, is our counter-example or counter-argument.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's not always going to be one way through this, right? There may be different... Yeah, did you want
to... Yeah, I just wanted to answer what Nick said. Say, education, naturally people will think wherever there might be a large youth in the population, as a great youth bulge, there might always be a tendency for conflicts. But my counter argument there would be also there, I believe, like in Africa, you have certain countries that, you know, in Africa, actually the population is much younger than in the West. It's the issue of greed and grievance might be overwhelming in society. The youth population is very, very large, but it might not necessarily be a tendency for them to make any violence. Reason being that there could be reprisals. It's not that they would not want to do that, but everything is held because they are sort of a dictatorial democracy.
Right.
So, in as much as all those factors will be suppressing them and they are very bad in other places, people might just. By just explode, but in certain other countries, it's not that they wouldn't want that, but you know what the reprisals may be.
So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot. Quite a bit there. I mean, I suppose my view on it would be on this youth bulge question. You, it's a kind of question. Some of them are like that, where if there's one term that's very central to it, you need to at least begin by saying what you think it is. So, with the youth bulge, if you don't qualify that it's not just anyone under 30. You probably want to somewhere in there say, well, really it's the 15 to 30 or 15 to 24 or 18 to 30. You want to kind of show that you're focusing in on something, recognize it as the issue. And then that's just definition, but then you would then go to the argument that this matters, which of course is in the meetings, but I suppose the counter argument might be that if a society is able to educate those people, is able to grow its economy in certain ways, then you could realize that demographic dividend, or perhaps that as you said, maybe other factors are just so much more important that whether the population is young or middle aged is not going to be the main driver. Or what you could then, and then I suppose once you've sort of laid out the counter argument, the other part of the counter argument might be that, you know, that it's poverty or it's some other factor rather than the youth that really is the driver of the conflict. So it's not, even if there's an apparent correlation between a young population and more violence. Actually, this is really a correlation between a poor population or a weak state or whatever other factor that's correlated with a young population. But it's the young population itself is not the driving factor. It's these other things that are really behind the violence. So that could be a counter argument. And then I guess in the conclusion, you might want to say, well, when conditions are A, B, and C, then a young population might be more sort of salient for violence. But in other situations, such as where you have a population that's maybe well-educated, the government does educate these people, or perhaps there are opportunities, then the violence won't happen. So that's a way of kind of making a conclusion that it's a bit like the diaspora's point, that in some cases yes and in some cases no. But as long as you've sort of shown that you understand the argument and the counter, that's the key really on that one. What did you guys?
We did a higher importance in population aging to the global balance of power in the 21st century.
Right. Yeah, it's hard because
the ones that show that is it something to do with like mental decline,
right?
Right. In the West, aging world. But then say come back to in that same article, I think it was talking about how it would have been important because all the NATO countries can just get together, but then none of the NATO countries can meet their defence spending obligations. Specifically in their aging, I'll take America, but a lot of them have got quite generous health provision, health and pension provisions, which is to eat the budgets. So I did this one for my essay question. Like, balance of power theory is quite an IR term, and I think I put too much IR in my essay. If that were the question in an exam, it's just, would you be prevented from answering that question if you weren't sure what, if it was a theory that you had ever heard of? So, because like balance of power, I think it's either a specific IR term or it can be quite a generic.
I think it can be generic. But I mean, the other point here, and I didn't mention before, is it's important, obviously, to answer the question and get the structure right. Within that, once you've done that, then yes, obviously, the more sophisticated answer that does bring in more angles to the question, or more, let's say, more demographic factors, or, you know, doesn't miss any, is clearly going to do better. But I just wanted to get you thinking first in terms of the structure. But yes, of course, beyond that, it is true that, you know, if you are able to set it within the context also of balance of power theory, then, you know, wow, that's great. I mean, that sort of adds something. But I wouldn't get, again, there's a danger there, though, if you start trying to do too much of that and you get it wrong, then, but yeah, just on the answer there, I think, yeah, you're right, you sort of set out the arguments in favor of the idea that it matters about military power, perhaps, and not being able to field as large a military, and be able to fund as large a military, all those Haas type arguments, and then you'd have, then the counter argument, which would be essentially about, you can age smartly by, and yes, you can increase the productivity of older people in the West, and so that can compensate in many ways for a higher dependency ratio and less money to spend on commentary. So you know, you can you'd bring in that kind of an argument, or it might be that who knows, maybe technology and mechanization might be able to make up for boots on the ground, whatever you want to bring in, and then to be able to then come to a conclusion. That's sort of the way I'd probably tackle it. And to the extent you can draw on writers like Shuba, I think, is on the other side of the coin from Haas, and you know, to be able to show you're aware of the arguments of different authors, and then bring in some case study evidence, all of that is grist for the mill. So so I'm just hoping that I've been able to kind of convey what we're looking for in these answers, that you're addressing the specific question, that you are having a structured argument. And then once you've done that, then it is about, you know, how sophisticated it is, how many different points of view you, or different elements that you can bring in. But I wouldn't have thought that just listing a bunch of stuff is going to get you very far either. So so that's kind of my advice, I guess. Any other further questions or clarifications?